You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, Donald Trump continues to consolidate his position as the Republican frontrunner after winning primaries in Michigan and Mississippi. But what about the underdogs? What keeps Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz and John Kasich in the race? I'll be discussing this with my guests today, Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb. In the last few days, the US claims it's killed dozens of al-Shabaab militants in Somalia and a top ISIS commander. But how trustworthy is the Pentagon as a news source? Plus, here in the UK, Buckingham Palace complains to the press watchdog after a newspaper claim that the politically neutral Queen had in fact taken sides on the country's EU membership. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, foreign affairs writer and former diplomatic editor of The Times, and Michael Goldfarb, reporter, author and broadcaster, currently working for Politico.eu. Welcome, Michael, and welcome, Michael. We'll begin with the US, and Donald Trump has strengthened his grip on the Republican nomination after winning primaries in Michigan and Mississippi. Things are not looking quite as bright for Hillary Clinton as she would have hoped after Bernie Sanders managed to pull off his biggest win of the Democratic race so far, defeating her in yesterday's Michigan primary. Trump, Clinton and Sanders are the candidates enjoying the most popularity, but let's not forget the underdogs in the race for the GOP nomination. And I wanted to look, Michael Goldfarb, first of all, at how this race is looking for Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio and John Kasich. Obviously, Donald Trump is by far and away the front runner. He seems to be essentially the only one who could win the nomination, it seems, before the convention. But it's not all over for the others, is it?
It isn't all over. What's interesting is that this is what happens when you allow unlimited amounts of money into the political process, which is, of course, something that the Republicans have made the most out of in the last decade or so, since the Citizens United Supreme Court decision said, well, you can have as much money as you like in. In previous go-rounds, most of these Republican contenders would have dropped out. They would have just run out of funds. You know, their backers would have said, you don't have a chance. Now they've got war chests and they can carry on as long as they like. I mean, Armageddon for both Kasich, is I think the way that he pronounces it, and Rubio will be next Tuesday, yet another Super Tuesday in this sequence. That's when Kasich, who's the governor of Ohio, there's an Ohio primary. Rubio, a senator from Florida, the Florida primary. If they cannot beat Donald Trump or be very close to him in their own home states, they're done. They will be told by their backers, you're finished, at which point it becomes a Trump and Cruz race to the nomination. And that will be incredibly interesting because Cruz is actually less electable than Donald Trump because he's just a nasty piece of work. The Senate, his fellow senators hate him. I can't imagine.
Not a single one has backed him.
I can't imagine what the Republican electorate will say, or the wider electorate they need to bring in to retake the White House.
Michael Binion, I think there was a piece by David Brooks in the last few days, which talked about Ted Cruz and said that if he's the candidate, he might win a few key counties in Mississippi at the general election. There is a real concern within the Republican establishment. Concern is rather understating it. That, yes, they want to stop Donald Trump, but my God, they don't want Ted Cruz to be the guy to do it.
Well, that's right, but I'm afraid they're lumbered with it because it's him or nobody, because I can't see Rubio catching up now. Even if he does win his own state in Florida, he's too far behind. And the problem is that Cruz is pretty combative. He won't give up. He feels he still has a chance. And it's going to be very difficult for the wise old heads in the Republican Party to think which is the least unelectable of these two. I mean, which one should they back? Because if you put either of them up against Hillary Clinton, I think they will both find that the vast majority of people who are not diehard Republicans will not go with either candidate.
Probably, but Michael Goldfarb, there is an argument that the argument against Ted Cruz is he's unelectable because he's too far to the right. The argument against Donald Trump for the Republican establishment isn't necessarily that he's unelectable, although, you know, it's not likely. It's also that his views are anathema to a number of the views held by the Republican establishment.
Well, the Republican establishment is a kind of amorphous term. There's parts of the Republican establishment that simply won't buy him, particularly those who worked very close with the Bush White House, the second Bush White House, the security establishment, the neoconservatives, cannot abide him. He's essentially, he's an isolationist. He's also so inexperienced in terms of foreign policy, they feel they couldn't possibly back him. But the rest of the Republican establishment, one isn't sure. And the one thing that I do know about Republicans, both as an American citizen and having written about American politics on and off, oddly, since I moved to London 30 years ago, I've done more reporting about American politics since I moved here, is that their core belief is winning. And if they can see a way of making Donald Trump a winner, it doesn't really matter what his ideology is. What matters is that they think they can project him into the hearts and minds of enough voters that he can win the White House for them.
Michael Binion, you said they're stuck with either Trump or Cruz. There is this sort of half suggestion that, well, look, if no one has a majority and we get to a convention and there's a bit of a fight, that maybe someone else can emerge through the middle, someone who we think would be more electable. I don't know, maybe we could put Mitt Romney back in there. You hear these things.
Well, it's whistling in the wind. It's looking back to the kind of way that things could be stitched up in the sort of 1920s and the 1930s when the party met in smoke-filled rooms and chewed things over.
Even more recently than that as well, in the 50s and 60s.
Well, there were pretty clear winners that came through in most of those primaries. There was no real challenge to Eisenhower, for example. He was head and shoulders above anybody else. And I don't think we've been lumbered with the situation before where the party simply can't really abide any of the two leading candidates. So how they manage that is going to be very difficult. I agree very much with Michael. They want to win. And in some ways, Trump is a sort of winner, and they're going to try to project him as another sort of Reagan, a man who is actually, he may sound pretty extreme when he's out there, campaigning, but when he comes into office, he's going to be a big unifier. He's going to sort of pull everyone together, and he's going to be a much more kind of solid figure.
Michael Goldfarb, it's hard to see how they can do that, though, when I saw some unfavourable figures for Donald Trump today. 46% of Republicans, not of voters, 46% of Republicans have an unfavourable view of the man who is quite likely to be their nominee.
I know, it's interesting, although I keep coming back to this very odd moment at the end of the last big debate, which was last week, and it was when Cruz and Rubio were beating up on Trump mercilessly, and he actually looked a bit uncomfortable, which is unusual for him because he's a very confident-looking guy when he's in the room. And at the end of this debate, when they've been beating him up, they were asked, the last question is, would you support him? And of course, they all said, yes, of course we'll support him, because the main objective is to defeat Hillary Clinton, who they assume, and I suppose you can still do that, but only not as much as last 48 hours ago, she will be the Democratic nominee. But it's entirely possible that, the persistence of Bernie Sanders may get him into the convention, and we may have precisely the kind of convention you were just outlining that the Republicans may want to have happen, so they can get a more moderate figure in. We may find that happening come the summer, because if you can win Michigan, and I think that Sanders possibly has a shot at winning the Ohio next week.
You really think he can turn this around?
I don't think he can turn it around enough to be the nominee going into the convention. I think he can keep the floor fight going long enough. He can every time he wins a state like Michigan, it exposes a weakness about Hillary Clinton. And, you know, we've still got months. She hasn't, you know, you forget that the pledged delegate count is different than the actual delegate count that we've been hearing about. And these superdelegates, they're not pledged to anyone. Mm-hmm. They could, in theory, go away. Right now they're being chalked up in her column. I just think that there's a lot to come in the next 60 days that we can't predict.
These are the superdelegates, which we heard a lot about 8 years ago, who are, let's face it, not democratically chosen. It's they are bigwigs within the Democratic Party who get a vote in who their nominee will be. And as Michael Goldfarb suggests, they may well switch around. Michael Binion, on the issue of Bernie Sanders and where he goes from here, he will be looking at this race and thinking, I'm doing rather well here in the North, aren't I? Hillary Clinton has done pretty badly up here. You know, the North is just as much a part of America as the South. If I can clean up here, I can do some damage.
He will be thinking that, but he's probably underestimating her campaign's ability to redefine her message and redefine her and to learn lessons. She's pretty agile in picking up where she needs to go and what needs to be the new message. I mean, she does have very high negatives, that's the problem, and her advisors know it. But they also know you need to get out there and talk to the Rust Belt more. You need to do something more about white working class people who are upset about trade deals, upset about what they see as adverse conditions for them. And she will be pretty quick at picking that up. Now, Sanders is very much a man trading on his kind of purity, his innocence, his newness, his fresh... Well, he's an old chap, but an old newness. He's a sort of Jeremy Corbyn figure in some ways, a sort of innocent abroad. And I think he will be rubbing his eyes whenever he wins a new state, saying, my goodness, you know, well, look what I've done. But I'm not sure that that's sustainable.
I think, the practicalities are that none of the Democratic primaries and caucuses are winner-take-all. So Bernie Sanders, who 48 hours ago was given a 1% chance of actually winning Michigan, won. And that's great for momentum. But in terms of the delegate pickup, he probably gets five extra delegates over Hillary Clinton out of Michigan. If he has a similar performance next week in Ohio. All right. So he's picked up an extra 10 out of winning two big states. So for him, the idea is that the more he can be seen to be either winning narrowly or fighting her to a near draw, the longer he can stay in the race. And the other thing, of course, is coming back to money. He doesn't get money from, he doesn't take money from bigwigs. But the small contributions he's been getting, he's raised something like $40 million in the last couple of weeks in $35, $50 contributions from people. And that's enough to sustain a guy for quite a while, and then people trip and fall. And in this political season, which is unlike any really since 1968, I think, anything can happen.
I want to just briefly go back to John Kasich. And if you were advising him, Michael Binion, right now, what would you be saying to him about the state of this race and what he can possibly achieve over the coming months?
I'd say to him, pull out.
Really?
Well, I think he just will be wasting his money. I just don't think... I mean, okay, possibly position yourself to be the one who might be a compromise candidate if the convention is deadlocked or if there's a real concern or if both the leading candidates in some way trip up. Make it look as though you are both available and electable, which means probably having to keep in the race to some point. But quite honestly, the numbers are against him and I don't see really that he can get anywhere.
And yet, Michael Goldfarb, were he to win Ohio and Rubio lose Florida, both of which are quite possible, in the case of Rubio losing Florida, quite likely, Rubio will pull out. Kasich will be the one, quote, normal guy standing. If he then, and again, the Republicans haven't had many northern states, you know, Kasich's strategy director is saying, look, you know, there's a lot of states coming up which we think will do very well for us. If he can pull off a few wins between now and the convention, then he could be there saying, hey, look, I was third, but no one's won this, broke a convention, I'm the compromise candidate.
Yeah, although on the current trajectory of delegates coming out of each primary, it may not get to the convention. That's the point. Kasich, I think, if he can win in Ohio. And the latest polling information I saw before I came in, and, you know, polls have been shown yet again to be slightly off, but as a snapshot, he may not win Ohio. Rubio is well behind in Florida. But again, in this time of money, Kasich can stay in. And, you know, the establishment, if Rubio drops out, can then sort of say, if there's one almost normal person, and his as a conservative, he's not as ideological as Ted Cruz. But I mean, and by the way, conservative ideology is not what it is in the UK or any other place on the face of the earth. I mean, he's not some, you know, Christian millennialist, which is what Ted Cruz is. And he's more than willing to compromise with Democrats to get legislation.
Yeah, let's not kid ourselves. This isn't an Angela Merkel style figure either.
Yeah, you know, he's not an insane person. He's pretty right wing, but he's not insane. You know, look, he could hang in, and there may be money coming in to say, hang in until a first round victory is assured for Donald Trump. And if that happens, then you have to drop out. But if Trump's delegate accrual is, you know, it's like your pension fund. If it doesn't accrue the kind of fund, the amount that you thought it would, you may have to work a little longer. And if Trump doesn't accrue delegates, he may have to campaign a little longer too.
I feel like we had a lot of ifs in there, but that's where we are right now. Okay, let's move on now. In other news, the US military says that a top ISIS commander, Omar Shishani, is likely to have been killed in an airstrike last week. If true, this could be conceived to be something of a victory in the US's efforts to strike the militant group's leadership. Just yesterday, the Pentagon's reliability as a news source was questioned though by, obviously, an opponent. The Somali rebel group Al-Shabaab claimed that the US had vastly exaggerated the number of casualties in a recent airstrike. According to the Pentagon, more than 150 militants had been killed, but Al-Shabaab said that it never gathers hundreds of fighters in one location for security reasons. So who to believe? Well, Michael Binion, there are obvious reasons why we shouldn't necessarily take Al-Shabaab's word as gospel, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And yet, the US, when it comes to announcing how many people they've killed, has admitted in the past that these are at best guesstimates.
Yes, they are guesstimates well informed by satellite observation and by eavesdropping. I mean, they listen to every communication on the ground. They pick up mobile messages. I mean, the terrorists themselves have learnt perhaps not to communicate by mobile for that very reason. Satellite observation can tell you a lot. I mean, it is pretty precise. And they try and triangulate their evidence in ways that they can sort of back it up by what then follows after an airstrike and what the reaction on the ground is and things like that. It is, in the end, of course, a guesstimate, but they're pretty accurate. I mean, when they got Mohammed Mwazi, known as Jihadi John, everyone more or less accepted it, and then it was shown by the militants themselves that that was indeed the case. So they can be fairly accurate. Al-Shabaab is a slightly different case. They're operating mostly in Somalia. I think the focus of American analysis and attention is clearly on Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. So there's going to be more accurate information there. What the rather more low-level conflict going on in Somalia happens to, you know, what comes out of that is probably less clear.
Michael Goldfarb, when George W. Bush was prosecuting a so-called war on terror, his advisor said, look, don't ask for numbers of militants that have been killed because these numbers are fairly meaningless. It's not as if there is a finite number of militants and if we kill 10,000 of them over the course of a year, they've all gone. And yet, there is an attraction to knowing, you know, for these people, of knowing how many have been killed, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, unless you are working the Pentagon, you can't, you know, as a foreign correspondent, and I've covered conflicts, and, you know, it was possible within reason to go off to the battlefield afterwards and see exactly for yourself, and you learn to be quite skeptical of the Pentagon. I must say that in this case, for example, I can think of at least two occasions in the last year when al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, went around the internet and some wire services reports out of Baghdad that he'd been killed. And the Pentagon said, no, we are looking into the situation. They've tended to be slightly more conservative in the last year in making assertions about who they've killed. So, as you said about Mohammed Anwazi, Jihadi John, this senior figure, was he Chechen or was that?
Oh, he was British.
No, he's, not Anwazi. The one who was killed yesterday.
Shoshani
was Chechen. I mean, if it is possible that ISIS will go ahead and make a propaganda video about this figure, because he's a well-known figure.
About his martyrdom.
About his martyrdom, yes. And that would be confirmation. And as you said, what would happen is people monitoring, and not just in the security establishment, there are people sitting in suburban rooms in the Midlands who monitor all kinds of things coming out of the Middle East, who there may well be a martyrdom video which would confirm it. In terms of Shabab, I mean, I don't know how you can tell these things. I mean, presumably, they're on the ground. They've got Kenyan security forces monitoring what goes on. Indeed, maybe even helping in spotting and
whether you trust them to say
again. I don't know if you can.
Quick final question on this, Michael Binion. Does it matter? Does it actually make a difference when, you know, in these two different cases, one where a group of militants have allegedly been killed, or another where a supposed top leader has been killed?
It doesn't matter at all in strategic terms, no. It matters simply in propaganda terms, and in terms of trying to dent the morale of ISIS fighters and to discourage people from going out from Europe or anywhere else and joining this group. So that's why they try to show that this lot is under severe attack, its leadership is being hit, its infrastructure destroyed, and it's on the run.
We'll leave it there just for now. Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb, thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a minute.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb. And now here in the UK, Buckingham Palace has complained to the press watchdog over a newspaper report that Queen Elizabeth backs a British exit from the European Union. According to The Sun, Queen Elizabeth had made her opposition to British membership of the EU clear on at least two occasions over the past decades. Buckingham Palace has now denied that this conversation took place. Michael Binion, first of all, do we believe that the Queen wants Britain to leave the EU?
I don't. I think the Queen has determined that she is not going to have a view on this because it's absolutely toxic to do so. In her heart of hearts, she is she's a person formed by the views around in the 1950s. So she might be a bit old-fashioned and might be somewhat suspicious of international entanglement, but she would certainly be far too shrewd and wise to let that come out.
Michael Goldfarb, reading this report, I kind of thought, well, I think this might be true, that she does, she had said this and she might think this. But being Eurosceptic doesn't necessarily mean you actually want to leave the European Union.
Exactly. I mean, the story is that in 2011, at a lunch at Windsor, she met the then Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg and was overheard saying to him, not as a talk or anything, just overheard saying to him, "Oh, I just don't understand Europe." Or words to that effect. And now, here we are in the midst of this heavy campaign, and this is spun out in The Sun, Britain's top-selling tabloid newspaper, as the Queen is for Brexit. And the sourcing on the story is a senior political figure or government figure even, who was, anyway, senior government figure.
Mm.
Okay, so that he's anonymous, senior government figure, can make this assertion because he heard her say this to Nick Clegg.
Well, he's not anonymous because several of papers have outed him.
They think Michael Gove.
It's the Justice of Secretary who is the leading, one of the leading figures in the cabinet who is in favor of leaving Europe.
And that's Michael Gove, who was there. And you know something I actually believe the Queen could say at a private lunch at Windsor.
Perfectly possible.
I just don't understand Europe.
Course.
And it might have been said in exasperation. It could have been said with an ironic twist. It could have just been an honest statement. Because who among us actually understands the machinations in Brussels?
And also, going back to my question, it's, you know, you can be, you know, Eurosceptic, you can be critical of the European Union and yet still believe that Britain should stay in the European Union.
But what's interesting, and Michael brings up Michael Gove. Michael Gove attended Rupert Murdoch's wedding over the weekend and whatever celebration followed. David Cameron did not, by the way. Mr. Murdoch owns The Sun. And I can imagine, over a glass of champagne, he let this slip, maybe even innocently. And I can also imagine Mr. Murdoch, who is known to phone the editor of The Sun, saying, I just heard this from Gove. This is a splash. Send Tom Newton Dunn, our chief political writer, to have him call him straight away. And so you have a story. Because
that sounds very plausible. And Murdoch, for all his weddings and all his age, is a very shrewd newsman.
When we go back to the Scottish referendum a couple of years ago, the Queen was put under a little bit of political pressure to come out in favour of Scotland remaining part of the United Kingdom. After all, it is technically still her United Kingdom. And Buckingham Palace was like, oh, no, don't worry. We're not going to get involved in this at all. We can't get involved in this at all. And yet, on one Sunday before the vote, she went to see a crowd of well-wishers outside Balmoral and just happened to say something to one of them about her views on Scottish independence, saying, I hope that people think very carefully about their vote. And as we know now, Michael Binion, that was a deliberate ploy. That was her attempt to get out the view that she really was in favour of Scotland staying in the UK.
It's almost impossible to be a head of state and have no view whatsoever on the main issues going on in the country. On the Scottish thing, of course, she comes out okay either way. She remains Queen of Scotland or of England or both. I mean, it doesn't. But clearly she did have a view. I think she was extremely sensitive to the dangers of speaking one way or the other, just to say, think very carefully. I mean, however you spin that, that is a perfectly reasonable and innocent remark. The other thing that was spun almost out of control was the news that after Cameron had telephoned her to say what the vote had been, she purred down the phone. In other words, she was pleased.
That wasn't leaked. That was David Cameron's own comment to Mike Bloomberg when he was visiting, which purred, I don't think she was perhaps happy. She certainly wasn't happy about the word used, let alone the view. Michael Goldfarb, does this matter? To go back to the question that we've been raising pretty much throughout the whole show, do you think this actually makes a difference to the terms of debate?
It won't change the debate on Brexit. I mean, I think that minds are pretty much made up. I don't know how much I haven't seen. I don't know how many people aren't sure which way they're going to vote.
I think it's about, frankly, to be honest, I think it's I don't think minds are necessarily made up.
I don't believe it. I think that there's a strong anti-European feeling, and each passing day, the inability to grasp the nettle on.
So you actually think minds are made up, as in like Britain will leave?
I think a lot of undecideds feel that there's this new thing that pollsters have figured out, that people are ashamed to say if they have an opinion that they think is a bad one. But in terms of the Queen, I mean, I think that this would be unprecedented for her to get involved in this kind of international political stuff, and it would go against her entire 63 years of public life to take a stand and allow it to get out. So I just think that this is a tabloid wonder.
And we'll leave it there. Michael Goldfarb, Michael Binion, thank you both very much indeed. That's it for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mari Giusti. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. We've got a bit of music next. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Giacopelli. Do stick around for that. The Michael Daily is later. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.